This is the London FinTech Podcast, bringing you practical insights and approaches, stories and inspiration from the innovators who are building the new world of financial services. This podcast is brought to you by NextWave, strategy specialists and solutions for financial institutions. Welcome to London FinTech Podcast. Today we're going to be talking about the state of FinTech in Europe with Finch Capital and also with one of the leading FinTech AI innovators. So I have two guests today, which is a bit of a departure for the show, but really looking forward to it. Finch Capital is a growth equity firm who provide funding for rapidly scaling companies, often preparing them for acquisition by PE firms. They were on the show a year ago when I was more or less starting out. And as their latest sector report is just out, I thought it'd be interesting to see how things have moved on from last year. I'm joined by Mike Brennan, a partner with the firm. Mike has been a startup founder himself and a venture advisor to the Irish government, amongst other things. And we also wanted to include the founder experience alongside the investor perspective. So I'm also joined today by a CEO from a Finch portfolio company, Parza Ghaffari. And Parza is an AI innovator and a technologist who founded Alien. They were a natural language processing and news intelligence startup who raised over $12 million in venture funding. They scaled a global client base and then assembled a team of 40 experts. And then they were acquired in 2023 by Quantexa. And Quantexa, also a friend of the London FinTech Podcast. They've been on the show a couple of times. So I'm sure there's some common reference points in the conversation coming up. We're going to focus on the Finch report today, but I'm really keen to hear Parza's experience, both as a startup founder and also as an AI practitioner. So welcome, Mike, and welcome, Parza.
Thanks, Tony. Great to be here.
Thank you.
So by way of background, Mike, is there anything I missed?
No, you didn't miss anything, Tony. My background is software engineering, actually. So I started my career as a software engineer with an NLP company. So obviously, hence why I got to know Parza over the years. And after that, then, as you rightly pointed out, I went through the kind of the founder experience myself, had my own startups, and also then worked investing public money for the venture arm of the Irish government for a number of years before joining Finch.
Yeah, and Parza, tell us a bit about your career to date.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, also a software engineer by background, and I started coding when I was about 8 or 9, and over time kind of got sort of more and more interested in the sort of business side of software businesses. Back in 2010, I got into AI through the sort of NLP route as well, so text analytics and dealing with textual data. And then shortly after that, in 2013, I started Alien, which, as you mentioned, was a startup focusing on text analytics and news intelligence that got acquired about 2.5 years ago by Quantexa. So for the past 15 years or so, I've been sort of building AI-centric software products, primarily in the context of financial services, serving banks, insurance companies, and so forth.
And just so that we know where we are currently, you're not with Quantexa anymore. I think post-acquisition, you were leading AI innovation on their side for quite some time. But I think I'm right that you recently started something new.
Sadly, I have moved on from Quantexa. I was getting married this year, last month in August. And yeah, I mean, after 10 years of running a startup and we had a successful integration and acquisition, obviously, with Quantexa, it was time for me to move on and explore my other colleagues.
Okay, well, maybe we'll hear a bit about that in a few minutes. And you guys already know each other, right? Even before Finch invested in Alien.
I think we've known each other now probably about 10 years, Parza, yeah? Yeah, we invested in Alien then in early 19 is when we invested. And we came in at the Series A round. We were kind of first talked to what Parza was doing. You know, it was he had some really good technology around kind of NLP and unstructured data, particularly ingesting kind of both news, social, etc., and creating risk signals for some of the leading kind of financial services companies like Wells Fargo, S&P. A very exciting company at the time.
So if you've known each other for over a decade, you've probably got a few stories about each other. I don't know how many of those are going to come out on this show, but let's see. And Parza, from your perspective, taking growth investment, how did that help? And perhaps what did you learn from that experience?
Yeah, no, great question. Yeah, I mean, so for us, the partnership with Finch was really critical in our journey back in 2019. And as Mike mentioned, they came in on the Series A, which is kind of when, you know, you sort of start to feel more like a scale up or kind of a more grown up, more mature company, you know, with sort of proper management structure and obviously initial product market fit that you can perhaps invest in further and sort of scale up your revenues and your growth. The key thing for us was like, we were still a little bit early by sort of Series A standards, perhaps. You know, we were still kind of, we had the early sort of market fit indicators. You know, we had a few large clients. I think ARR-wise, we were maybe at just under $1 million or so when Finch came in. So, you know, by all sort of standards, we were still a sort of, you know, early stage startup looking for market fit. But then gradually, you know, the investment allowed us to explore a bit, well, firstly, validate the product market fit we had at the time, which was all around sort of market intelligence and risk intelligence, looking for indicators of risk in the global sort of news and media, which is typically in unstructured format. But it also allowed us to kind of go up the value chain. Post Finch investment, we started looking a bit more closely at financial services as a sort of a sector of special interest, I suppose. Looking at banks, talking to a large number of especially risk departments within several banks, we sort of ran a process where we spoke to a lot of CROs and risk managers and risk analysts. So really sort of the very top of the stack, you know, C-suite within risk, all the way down to sort of the day-to-day operators around, you know, risk management, risk analysis, sort of early risk indication and analysis by banks and insurance companies. And we sort of, it really allowed us to kind of evolve the product that we were serving or selling into the market to be a bit more sort of aligned with that vision of, you know, data-driven risk management, data-driven risk analysis. So, you know, it kind of, you know, again, allowed us to scale what we were already sort of doing and doing well, but also sort of go deeper into the industry and go up the value chain.
Yeah, and I can see, for those who know Quantex, the alignment between risk indicators and network graphing and pattern detection for risk and actually for new clients and other things these days. But the alignment between Quantex's technology and what you're doing is pretty obvious. I'm curious, you know, in the context of what's happened in AI since the advent of ChatGPT and the exponential interest and investment and growth curve exit, it feels to me anyway, it feels relatively early in that continuum. And I'm curious, sort of how big were you and what was behind the decision to look for sort of bigger parentage back then?
Yeah, absolutely. I think the strategic fit, as Mike alluded to, was really strong because Quantex historically had been fantastic with structured and semi-structured data, you know, in the sort of in crime space. A lot of what they did was around transaction data, company profiles, entity resolution, that sort of stuff, which primarily relies on structured data, which is, you know, your data that sits in databases and sort of in a structured tabular format. I imagine an Excel sheet or like a database table. Whereas, you know, Alien, you know, we had invested a decade and you know, $12 million dollars of investment into getting really good at unstructured data and understanding, you know, text primarily. Even today, like 80% of the world's data within the enterprise, at least 80%, is in unstructured form. And you look at, you know, a typical bank or a typical insurance company, you have all these kind of stacks and heaps of textual content, you know, contracts, internal guides, manuals, customer data. But they sort of pre-ChatGPT, this was a complete sort of black box, you know, companies weren't able to take advantage of this type of data. So by bringing that together with the Quantexo platform, we could really sort of offer this very compelling, complete picture to a sort of a financial institution, be it, you know, again, in sort of credit applications, be it in compliance, be it in even sort of the growth side, as you alluded to, Tony, around customer intelligence. You know, how much do we understand about our customers? What are the upsell, cross-sell opportunities? So all of that, you know, when you bring the capability of unstructured and structured together, just kind of gives you a much a bigger and richer sort of picture of, you know, the kind of environment you're operating in. So from that standpoint, the strategic fit was really sort of, I suppose, what made both companies consider the partnership. We had had several acquisition offers and interest in the past as Alien, but this was kind of very much directionally sort of aligned with where we were going as a company, you know, doubling down on financial services. And again, the sort of very credible company that Quantexo is, the kind of the range of customers they had, the depth of integration they have into the market, it just kind of made them a natural sort of home for Alien. Then there's all the other things, you know, the sort of the culture fit was a key, really key factor. You know, the companies were built by very sort of similar people and, you know, with similar mindsets and very similar teams and culture and so forth. So that all sort of added, I suppose, to it. But as you kind of alluded to, yeah, obviously the market has sort of changed drastically in the last 2 or 3 years. And it's one of those, like, one of those questions we'll never be able to answer, I think, as to, you know, would it have been better to kind of wait for the ChatGPT thing to sort of unfold versus, you know, sell when we did. We unfortunately can't answer that, but it was a successful exit for our team, for Quantexa, for our investors. So all in all, I think we're broadly happy.
It was a real 1+1=3, and even if you look at it, this was Quantexa's first and only acquisition. So I think that also shows how strategic this was. They didn't have this capability internally, and they needed to buy in this technology, which, as Parsa mentioned, Alien were both thought leaders and some way ahead of the curve on.
Yeah, there's a great synergy there. It's a great story. And as we all know, the AI startup market is littered with people who think they have a big moat and then realize they don't when one of the foundation labs or someone releases a very similar capability. And I think, you know, well, you said you're very happy with the way things have turned out. The timing and the alignment there looks spot on. And it's a great story of growth investment really driving scale out in the sector, which is a nice segue back to the headline topic for today's conversation, which is the state of European fintech. We looked at this a year ago with Mike's partner, Armin, and we went through some really interesting headlines around where Europe was at versus the US at the time and the types of investment that the sector was receiving. So I'm really curious to get some updates a year later. You know, how's this all played out? And then perhaps given the audience and given the fact that we've got both of you on the show, perhaps we'll take a slightly deeper dive on some of the AI headlines that are coming through from the report and try and put a bit of color on that. Before we jump right into today's episode, a quick thank you to our sponsor, NextWave. NextWave is an award-winning consultancy that is helping many of the world's leading banks, investment managers, and insurers deliver on their growth, efficiency, risk, and control goals and transform their businesses. With a senior team who have come from MD-level positions in major firms like HSBC, Barclays, and UBS, NextWave has both the deep industry expertise and the hands-on capabilities in AI, data, and automation to drive real results. More business outcomes and less PowerPoint from the consulting experience, as their clients like to say. NextWave has moved 2-week manual processes to 5-minute agentic automations, rescued global banking regulatory control programs, and digitized deal platforms, sustainability, and regulatory reporting systems. And they do much of this with hands-on engineering capabilities on leading technologies, which include ServiceNow, Alteryx, Quantexa, and Komunda. So if a modern and specialist alternative to the big brand consulting model sounds appealing, one which covers the full life cycle of strategy specialists and solutions, but with small practitioner teams, rapid delivery, and a better price point, then perhaps you should talk to NextWave. Visit nxwave.com to find out more and get in touch. That's nxwave.com. All right, let's get back to the episode. To get us started, Mike, this is the 10th anniversary of the analysis that you've done for the sector. It's super comprehensive. The report, for those who download the report, or at least the version I've got, comes in 3 sections. And I think that's because it's just easier to digest that way. There are some sector headlines. There's a deep dive by country. There's a deep dive by trend across the sector. So there's an awful lot we could talk about, but perhaps you can sort of guide us top down. What are the headlines for 2025?
Yeah, there's a lot to probably digest as you discovered, Tony. If anyone's interested, you can get the report on finchcapital.com/research, and there's some commentary. But maybe just to take a kind of a step back and look at kind of what the big picture is, right? As you mentioned, this is kind of our 10th edition. So, you know, we're getting a much clearer picture of how the sector has evolved. But looking at the big picture, I think the report is pretty clear that fintech has matured. It's not just a niche or a trend. It's a sector pretty much that is holding up European tech. If you look at the report and the kind of the headline on this, in the first half of 2025, I think fintech captured pretty much a quarter of all VC funding in Europe. And that's pretty remarkable resilience at a time when other verticals have struggled. I think here's probably the big kicker, which you've alluded to, Tony, is that Europe is increasingly seen as kind of a safer, longer term bet than the US. Valuations are steadier, political volatility feels lower, and regulation is actually a strength, a drag. And so I think if you are a global investor and looking for stability and scale, Europe is suddenly a very attractive destination.
Yeah. And what about the shape of that investment? Are we seeing smaller deals, bigger deals, particularly?
Yeah, I think that's probably more kind of, I suppose, aspect to come out of the report. I think one of the big themes this year is concentration. And I think while deal volume is down, about 30% fewer fundraising rounds than last year, the amount of money invested is actually up by about a quarter, yeah, and by about 23%, I think, off the top of my head. And that what this tells investors is that, you know, we are making kind of fewer bets, but we're making bigger bets, and we're putting capital behind what we feel are the established winners rather than kind of spreading it more thinly across the sector. So I think everything points to kind of a maturing sector.
Yeah. And if you're a fintech founder out there, what does that mean practically for you? You know, as the sector's been growing up, there have been phases where there's been a lot of investor money for things that are relatively early stage, pre-profit. You've already talked about bigger deals, which presumably means that these firms are further up the maturity curve. But what do you look for in terms of an investable proposition?
Yeah, well, I think what we look for, obviously, you know, I mean, and I can only speak to our strategy. Yeah, so I mean, obviously, we invested in Alien back in 2019. That was a little bit earlier than we would typically invest. So, yeah, where we focus right now is in that kind of 2 to 15 million ARR businesses. That's kind of our sweet spot. Where, as Parsa alluded to, there's a level of product market fit, and that we can go on that scaling journey with the company. But I think to your point of kind of, you know, what's in this for founders right now, and how can they look at the market? I suppose one big thing that to come out of this, and which I touched on there with regards to obviously Europe vis-a-vis the US, is that US investors are back. They make up 28% of all transactions in European fintech, which is the highest level since before 2020, right? So I think there's a lot of positives for founders, particularly European founders.
Yeah. And how are you seeing the geographical breakdown? I've had guests on this show from firms like Robinhood, IBAN First, who are prioritizing a key location in London in the overall European footprint. And I believe your report measured that UK is getting more than the rest of the sector put together, I think is probably the best way to say it. But how do you see the geography split, Mike?
Yeah, so obviously the high level is a little bit more maybe more consistent than just kind of, you know, I suppose if you look at the geographic elements of this, yeah, it's not the same story everywhere, as you rightly point out. Yeah, if you look at kind of, I think the UK is very much center stage. The UK still dominates. And I think more than half of European fintech funding goes there. And even within the UK, I think London alone accounts for 80% of that deal volume. So I think there's no probably surprises there. And if you think back to maybe kind of the last conversation you would have had with my colleague Aman, it's probably kind of a similar trend for the UK market. I don't think this is any surprise, really, right? Like if you look at kind of, I suppose, the homegrown talent in the kind of the UK and the kind of the giants that are emerging kind of with, you know, Monzo, Starling, et cetera, yeah, and Revolut. I think, look, you know, I mean, it is the fintech powerhouse of Europe, yeah? But that's not to say that, you know, I mean, there's some close rivals. I think Germany and France were probably the closest challengers if you look at the data from our report. I think Germany saw some very large kind of AI-driven compliance and wealth tech deals. And then if you look at kind of other geos like the Netherlands and Ireland, you're starting to see that kind of, that I mentioned earlier, that concentration piece starting to creep in with the likes of Nomopay in Ireland, which is a Finch Capital portfolio company, driving large amounts of the of the funding raised in that geo, and also in the Netherlands, you see the same with Finon. Yeah, so I think it's not like for like across Europe, but I think the UK still center stage and dominates.
Yeah. And the third dimension of the report is by trend. And I'd like to bring Parza in on this one, because I think certainly for me, and I'm sure you guys are going to agree, one of those mega trends is AI. But having perhaps lifted your head out of post-acquisition, Parza, I haven't given you an opportunity yet to tell us about what your new thing is, but what are you seeing across the market? And it'd be interesting then to get Mike's reflection on whether that ties up with the analysis. But what do you think is driving the opportunities out there?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, when you look at the big picture with AI today in the industry, I kind of like to break it down into two sort of fundamental forces. One is the kind of intelligence level that we get from the current models coming typically out of, you know, a handful of frontier labs, your OpenAIs and DeepMinds and so forth. And then the second element is integration of that level of intelligence into various sort of business applications. And the sort of the dynamics are largely driven by these two forces. I think what we see in the market is that on the integration side, there are a few like established use cases with clear ROIs, you know, things like software development, for example, with your sort of cursors and cloud codes and all of that sort of co-assisted software development or co-pilot software development is a fairly established, you know, the ROI is fairly clear. It's one of the sort of booming use cases. Similarly with things like customer support and those type workflows, we've seen, again, clear ROIs. And obviously, both of these apply to financial institutions largely. You know, we obviously see a lot of software development activities as well as some sort of customer facing elements and workflows that have benefited massively from the sort of the recent boom in AI. But outside of this, a lot of what we've seen is experimentation, right? So you kind of look at the large corporations, you know, your sort of tier one banks and so forth. A lot of the effort has been sort of in the past 2 years funneled into sort of prototyping activities, perhaps using new technologies and looking at a lot of the sort of fundamental assumptions around the operational models of these financial institutions, kind of department by department, function by function, line by business line. So if you're kind of looking at your, I don't know, KYC and AML type stuff, or if you're looking at your credit decisioning type stuff, or if you're looking at customer intelligence and the growth side, there's a lot of experimentation happening there, lots of prototypes. I think over time, the prototypes are maturing and the use cases are becoming clearer and clearer. But I suppose one thing that is fairly clear and obvious is that in terms of the killer applications, we haven't really sort of come across anything that's as big in the short term as the first two use cases and applications that I mentioned. But obviously, there's a lot of hope, there's a lot of potential. But sort of going back to that, the two-dimensional movement and motion, or the sort of the two forces of intelligence and integration, it is a bit of a, you know, until the next breakthrough comes on the intelligence front, we might be a little bit limited in terms of what new use cases AI can sort of fundamentally solve at these organizations. So, you know, every generation of these AI models that has come out has made new things possible. And, you know, there's a lot of sort of reasons to believe that the next breakthrough is around the corner. Big companies, big labs are investing obviously massively into finding the next breakthroughs and hoping that the sort of scaling laws continue to make these models better and more capable. But that's kind of a snapshot of what I've seen in the market.
Yeah, I really like that. Very simply put, intelligence and integration and pushing on both fronts. And I talk about this a lot on this show. I mean, for me, everything falls into the business strategy. It starts with the business strategy. So growth, efficiency, risk and control. And that's where the sector is focusing from a business perspective. But AI and the other mega trend that's out there, which is all things crypto, driving those business opportunities. And Mike, how does this line up with the research and perhaps what you're seeing across the different areas of the sector?
Yeah, no, it's quite interesting. It kind of reminds me of maybe a few years back when we talked about kind of embedded finance. And it feels like every company is going to be an AI company to some degree. What's kind of interesting, and kind of what's the kind of the interesting paradox here from what we've seen, is that while AI is everywhere in the conversation, it's not yet dominating the funding. And what I mean by that is, you know, I mean, I think over 20% of the fintech deals are AI led, but those only capture 7% of the funding value. So I think what this shows is that it's still very early stage. Lots of experimentation, as Parza mentioned, but the mega rounds still yet to come. And then maybe on the R&D side, from what we saw from the report, I think we've hit what kind of Finch calls like peak engineering. And what we mean by that is, you know, if we look back at, I suppose, R&D hiring over the years, it slowed pretty much to a crawl. I think back in 2022, we saw kind of 20% growth, and that's down to kind of 2% so far this year. So instead of hiring armies of engineers, companies are looking for specialists like prompt engineers, and how they can optimize AI tools and how they're used across the organization, as Parth mentioned.
It's fascinating. I mean, there's a couple of things there that you've sort of unpacked, Mike. The funding paradox. So if it's just 7% of total funding, suggesting we're very early in the AI investment cycle, that's curious given the amount of focus and headlines and activity that's going on in all things AI across. Let's talk about that one for a minute. You know, what's your take on why that's still a sort of single digit number?
Yeah, I just think the reality here is that, you know, it's still very early. I don't think there's anything really to dig hugely into this. Yeah, I think there's a lot of hype and there's a lot of conversation, as I said. And I think, Parse has been at the coalface of this, right? But I think you're really only starting to see kind of the sector emerging. You know, I mean, while more generally in fintech, we're seeing a much more kind of mature space. And those kind of larger rounds, so obviously the bigger checks, but less volume. But I think in AI, and if you look at kind of, if you break that down into its constituent parts, yeah, we're seeing just kind of early stage activity, which I think makes sense given where we are on this journey.
Yeah, I think it's the maturity point for me. We've seen the advantage of AI coding assistance, and there's some knowledge base and chatbot maturity out there. But the integration point that Parth raised, sort of rewiring AI into the regulated complex workflows of the enterprise, in many cases it's not there yet, and this sort of promised land of agentic teams all working autonomously to many times scale the capacity of the organization and deal with your customers in a responsible and safe way, I mean, that's somewhat of a way off, I think.
If we look at payments, I think like very much kind of there's a lot of buzz around agentic payments and kind of where AI agents can, I suppose, handle payments autonomously. And I think, but this is still very early days, all right. But I think if you look at some of our companies and what they're doing, right, we invested in a financial management system called Accounts IQ. They're looking now at how they can integrate payments, automate workflows for the office of the CFO. So I think, well, some of this stuff seems kind of a little bit further afield, it's actually real and in development, if not in production today.
Yeah, I think there's a groundswell building up, and we're going to start to see some of these applications go mainstream fairly soon. You know, there's a few things that that we've looked at, and we've built, and my consulting team built an agentic front office, back office reconciliations. So for those out there in the banking world, this thing called a FOBOREC, which is the front office record versus the back office record of trading activity. I mean, all firms do it at scale. It's a fundamental part of product control. It's a very important process, often run on spreadsheets. And we've got an agentic team doing that on some analytics platform tech, using Gen AI to run the process. Whilst the headlines might scream, I think MIT wrote that 95% of AI POCs are not going to return business value. There's the other 5%, and we are starting to see some very interesting things. And we saw something the other week that purports to be explainable AI for doing product recommendations in the advisory space for banks. I mean, and if someone cracks that, then I think that opens up a big opportunity. But I'll bring Parser in on this one, because if I remember rightly, I'm pretty sure your LinkedIn posts suggested that you've been building agentic teams, or at least you're hands-on with some of this. So I'm curious your perspective on the maturity point and you know, where we're going to see first value perhaps at some scale.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, so I've been as a practitioner with my practitioner hat on, building agents of various descriptions for various use cases. We had a very successful project at Quantixa called QAssist, which is essentially your sort of co-pilot that sits alongside Quantixa for, you know, across a range of use cases, you know, be it sort of AML investigations or, you know, where you kind of very similar to your sort of FOBO rack concept. You know, there's, for example, things like suspicious activity reports that need to be drafted, and they used to sort of take weeks for a team of, you know, human analysts to draft up. Whereas, you know, those are like some obvious use cases for Gen AI, as well as sort of, you know, investigative co-pilots and so forth. So that, you know, that's kind of one aspect. The other aspect is some of the personal projects I've been working on around automating tasks in the browser. You can kind of think of it as a sort of a future or like the next iteration of, you know, browser automation style tools and robotic process automation style tools. And to be honest, my the upshot for me there is that the tech just isn't there yet for some of these use cases to work reliably enough. So it really depends on the use case and your tolerance for error and your sort of risk appetite when it comes to, you know, putting your software out there and so forth, which is actually, I think, a new concept because it used to be quite deterministic, right? So you would kind of write the software to hit a set of specs and, you know, you would sort of have your QA process to test for those use cases. And if it passed those use cases, your software was sort of broadly good to be put out there in the real world. Whereas obviously what we see now with AI and with agents that have, you know, LLMs as their kind of brain equivalents, there's this a higher degree of uncertainty. You might sort of, you know, which is kind of the classical dilemma of today, which is things demo well, you know, 8 out of 10 times, but then the other 2 times, we kind of, some of your listeners may have seen what happened with the Meta demo a few days ago with the sort of Ray-Ban glasses. You know, there's the odd case where the sort of the uncertainty will just kind of fail you. And again, if you're looking at access to a knowledge base for like, you know, kind of an internal staff base sort of rag, yeah, maybe you can kind of put that out there because 5% error rate is fine. But if you're looking at credit decisioning, you know, deciding who to give a mortgage to and who not to give a mortgage to, you probably, you know, we're not there yet where you can have like a, you know, an AI sort of agent evaluates all of that and make a decision. There's a long list of kind of gaps and limitations that these models have. But again, the funny thing about where we are right now is that we have seen enough promise, like the industry has seen enough promise to keep investing and keep exploring, but we all need to sort of be also mindful of the limitations. And again, a lot of these limitations, I don't think we can solve through integration alone. I think broadly speaking, we're all sort of waiting for the sort of the frontier labs to kind of, you know, give us the next level of intelligence that might, you know, reduce the error rate from 5% to 1%.
And Parsa, maybe just a quick question, if I can play host, Tony, apologies.
Knock yourself out.
Yeah, no, I'm just curious, kind of been at the coalface, right? Because one thing that we see is obviously all this operational efficiency that can be brought in, yeah. But then there's obviously the compliance department and how they look at this and how they sweat this. What's your take on that and how do you get the balance?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, you know, having worked in more regulated industries like financial services, and statistics and models aren't new in sort of financial services. You know, they've been in use for decades and there have been sort of well-known processes even around deep learning models for, you know, how you go about developing a model, how you go about, you know, explaining your decisions with regards to how you design your model and how you implemented it to the regulators. All of that sort of used to be fairly clear, you know, up until like 2021, 2022, you know, again, established processes around that with model risk governance and so forth. Whereas with the advent of LLMs, it just kind of made it that much harder to sort of come up with explainable sort of answers or, you know, explanations for a regulator as to, you know, which of these, you know, like you fed a 2-page document into an LLM and decided, you know, that, you know, an individual is perhaps a high-risk individual or so. But how do you explain, you know, the billions of parameters that are sort of interacting with each other inside an LLM? So that kind of created a lot of challenges around transparency, explainability and so forth, which I think initially gave a pause to a lot of, you know, compliance teams in terms of the adoption of these technologies. I kind of remember this vividly back in 2023. There was a kind of a strong, we can't use these LLMs, you know, until we've sort of figured out the sort of regulatory side of it, et cetera. But then the cost, the opportunity cost of kind of sitting out of this sort of innovation race was too high. So I think basically what happened then was things like sort of approved standard architectures, right? What I saw with banks, for example, is kind of these reference architectures for how you can and cannot use, you know, LLMs within the bank. And while, you know, the regulatory side is kind of being sort of worked out, and we obviously had a few big events around that last year, you know, with sort of various AI acts, both in Europe, UK, as well as the US, where kind of regulators are getting, you know, on top of things and getting a good understanding of how to regulate this type of technology. But again, banks didn't want to, financial institutions broadly, have that sort of hamper their innovation. So, you know, there's a lot of best practices that are now established, I think, in the industry. And hopefully that answers your question.
We're going to be doing, well, I'm going to be doing a special on AI governance later this week, actually. I'm very excited about that upcoming conversation. So I've got Dr. Paul Donger, who's just written a book on it with the White House AI advisor. So watch this space for upcoming episode, and we'll dig into all of the responsible, safety, compliant AI dynamics, and hopefully provide a bit of a playbook for enterprises, because that whole side of this is maturing, you know, at pace to try and keep pace with the model innovation and the excitement and the business opportunity that everyone sees. And it is super important given the bias, the hallucination rates, the danger of, you know, treating your vulnerable customers incorrectly under consumer duty or whatever it might be. If you start deploying Gen AI in the wild, it's a high stakes game.
And also data going out of these organizations as well through shadow AI tools. And so there's a lot to consider in that. Yeah, it's a fascinating topic.
There is. The other big trend that you mentioned, peak engineering, I want to come back to that in a minute. But if we could just talk first, because we started to dig into it a little bit about the value stream and the value chain across different areas of the sector, perhaps where we're seeing the AI activity and the AI advantage starting to pull ahead. The one that I've noticed, and I think you called it out in the report, I noticed it personally, I'm going to one of the insurance innovation conferences a few months back, is underwriting. And that was just so prominent. There were sort of 30 stage presentations, and I think 20 something had AI in the title. And of those, about half of them were AI powered underwriting propositions of some sort. Perhaps because it's such a clear use case, perhaps because the data's out there. Interesting, definitely a focus area. So I'd be interested to get your take on that one. And perhaps what else popped out from the analysis as to sort of where everyone's placing their bets on AI currently across the sector?
I think from the report perspective, I'll let Parsa maybe, because I'm sure Parsa is looking at lots of different use cases at the moment, and he can give his take on this. But from the report, you're right. I think if you look at insurance underwriting, yeah, I think there's efficiencies to be gained there. I think also in lending, you know, I mean, we've seen a lot of kind of underwriting cycles around lending as well. You know, we've seen that being cut hugely as well, from kind of 12 days down to kind of just over 2 days. And then wealth management as well. I think that's another sector that's capitalized and leveraged AI very effectively, with firms using generative AI to automate reporting, improve client services, and just in general, squeeze costs. But maybe Parsa's got some maybe Horizon 2 applications that he's looking at.
Yeah, absolutely. So yeah, I mean, aside from those kind of, yeah, like this horizontal layer of applications around, you know, report generation, you know, software development, data analysis, that sort of stuff. But I think that maybe the Horizon 2 stuff that I kind of got exposed to, things around simulations, things around scenario analysis, right? So you kind of look at sort of macro or geopolitical risks, you know, from the perspective of a bank, a large bank. You know, there are obviously established practices around, you know, kind of thinking through the emerging risks and the consequences and creating scenarios that get tested. And I think AI has a huge role to play in that area. You kind of see this emergent sort of world models that some of the frontier labs call them, you know, essentially kind of creating a digital twin. I mean, I'm not a huge fan of that phrase, but kind of creating a digital twin of a bank's kind of operations, you know, the regulatory environment they exist in, the customers they have, the exposure they have to various geographies, and then sort of overlaying on top of that things like sort of news, you know, either real news scenarios, things that are happening in real time, or perhaps fictional news scenarios, right? What could happen, you know, you know, the current, obviously, stage we're at in the world, you know, there's several sort of macro geopolitical events that are kind of evolving over time. So it's very important to kind of stay abreast of those. And then, you know, some of the projects that we worked on, for example, around this are focused on using AI agents to play out these scenarios, right? So instead of relying on human intuition to say, you know, if this thing happened, we think these are the consequences, can we sort of encode that, you know, sort of cause and effect knowledge in a set of AI agents to kind of play out these scenarios, perhaps explore millions of them, rank them based on, you know, plausibility and impact and likelihood, all the kind of various dimensions that we love in risk, and then flag those to human analysts, right? Kind of do some of their thinking for them in terms of, you know, similar to deep research that we use in sort of ChatGPT and similar solutions. So, you know, there's like, I think once the dust settles on the Horizon 1 use cases and organizations feel like they're kind of on top of those and reaping the benefits of those more basic use cases, I think there's a wide scope in terms of more creative and sort of perhaps more tailored and organization-specific applications of AI that we're going to see in the next, hopefully, 1 to 3 years, I'd say.
I think that simulation use case is fascinating. I talked with Rob Wilson on a recent podcast around that topic and the exponential requirement for GPU chips and infrastructure that's going to come with mass simulation.
Absolutely. Absolutely. Yeah. I mean, so that's, it kind of makes sense, I think, in the future to have, you know, again, these kind of simulated worlds where if you want to understand the impact of a geopolitical event or, you know, perhaps your competitor's strategy, right? So what happens if my competitor does X or Y? What does that mean for me? Again, play out all the scenarios, perhaps pick the winning strategies and, you know, show me the sort of the top three. So you can kind of almost see this, you know, digital twin CEO that's like behind the scenes just thinking about your business while you kind of go to bed at night, and then the next morning you come and it presents you with all these findings and insights. And obviously that's going to cost a lot of GPU hours, but there will come a point where that sort of that cost makes sense to pay.
Yeah, I've seen a few LinkedIn posts about digitizing the CEO, so the real CEO could take some time off. But yeah, I'm not sure we're quite there yet. So the Finch analysts have called out some really interesting stats there. I mean, it was sort of buried in what Mike said, but if you took a lending down from 12 days to 2 days, I mean, that's extraordinary. And there are a whole stack of use cases lining up behind it. There's also something that was there in the report headlines, which I wanted to just come back to, which was this concept of peak engineering. Because on one hand, we've just been talking about how the sectors, in AI terms at least, and investment in AI, it's relatively early in maturity. So the investment numbers are still single digits and there's lots that lies ahead. On the other hand, but there's a bit of an arms race and a race to get to deploy. And yet there's a downtick in demand for R&D and engineering capabilities. And maybe that's because the first use case to get out there is GitHub Copilots and AI coding assistants. You don't need as many engineers, but it does seem to be slightly pulling in the opposite direction to the overall pace of adoption and focus that the sector has. So, Mike, that one, peak engineering, where did you land on that label, and what's your thought on what's driving that statistic?
Yeah, I just think we've moved from, I suppose, you know, I mentioned obviously the stats, the raw data on it, but I think we've moved from, I suppose, period of, I suppose, brute force headcount now to kind of more AI powered productivity. And I just think, even if we look at our own portfolio and, you know, the adoption of AI tools across the R&D functions within our portfolio, which probably is probably a signal to what we're going to see in larger organizations as well, from kind of what would have historically been kind of code pairing, now using kind of, you know, GitHub Copilot to utilizing Cursor. There's a whole plethora of tools out there that can be used. You know, I integrated a MailChimp API into our Finch Capital website the other day. It took me a few minutes, where it might have taken me a few hours previously. Across the board, there's efficiencies to be gained. That's just a very simple example.
Are your portcos vibe coding their next products at this stage? Are you seeing that?
Yeah, I've spoken to Paris as well on this. I think some of these tools are great for maybe just getting kind of an MVP or some sort of kind of, you know, very early stage prototype. But I think, you know, I think to actually build something to some degree of, I suppose, substance, I think you're not going to probably use some of these kind of vibe coding type tools. But if you want to just have a simple proof of concept, yeah, it's perfect. And, you know, you can do this in hours, if not days. And But I think maybe where some of the tools come in is maybe just in the more general, just kind of efficiency and just how obviously these teams operate. But I'll let Parsa give his take on that too.
Yeah, absolutely. I think one of the things that I really like about this kind of whole vibe coding trend is exactly that point, how easier it has become to develop, you know, MVPs and prototypes. And I think there's an, you know, there's an efficiency element to that with, you know, reducing perhaps the workload for core engineering teams who are kind of, you know, building the more sort of mission critical parts of your software. But I think there's a democratization element to it as well. So if you look at a large organization, your PMs, for example, or even perhaps your GTM teams can now, you know, use tools like Lovable and Cursor and so on to perhaps, you know, test the concept, right? So come up with a sort of quick and hacky prototype that they can put in front of customers. It's more interactive than your sort of Figmas of the past, perhaps, you know, kind of the standard wireframing tools. And, you know, so that means that, you know, they get you that bit closer to product market fit and market validation of new ideas. So I think on, you know, if you kind of zoom out, I think it's great for innovation, for discovering the next thing to build. It's not there yet, as Mike said, for production level engineering. And, you know, it has consequences as well. Like one of the services I just saw emerging is this kind of vibe code cleanup services, because as organizations do kind of more and more this kind of vibe coding, they also accumulate a lot of sort of AI slop, so to say, that then needs to be kind of, that's a new form of like technical debt, right? And you kind of need to pay that off at some point. So I saw a post on Hacker News yesterday of a company that just specializes in, you know, we clean up your AI slop in your code after, you know, your engineers have created tons of it. And you know, that could pose a risk, you know, that could cause all sorts of issues if you don't deal with it. So it could create new opportunities as well, is what I'm trying to say.
I hadn't heard vibe coding cleanup. We're coming across more and more sort of rapid prototypes that are built with Vercel or Replit or Lovable, and it's definitely out there. But the commentary I'm hearing is it's not ready for the enterprise, and it's just quite enterprising of someone to start offering that service. Love that. So we could talk about the stats and the report dimensions. Just looking more ahead, I'm curious on predictions and where we think this is going. I quite like the phrase you were both using a few minutes ago about Horizon 2 and what's coming next. The consulting business that I run is called Next Wave, and we cunningly landed on that headline so that we're never going to be out of fashion. But with the models increasing their capability every 4 months, I believe, the AI model and the evolution across the sector, and it's not just AI, it's also crypto, it's buy now, pay later, it's the payment space, it's all the things that are happening at an ever-increasing pace. Perhaps, what are your thoughts on, and it'd be more interesting to ask about next year, I think, rather than this year, because at the time of this recording, we're sort of hurtling towards Christmas. But if you look at 2026, Mike, any thoughts? What do you think we're going to see next year in fintech?
Yeah, I think, as you rightly point out, it's not all around just AI. I think you mentioned, obviously, kind of, I think if you look at, I suppose, yeah, I think look, AI is obviously reshaping everything and it's kind of redefining the rules of the game. But I think, you know, I mean, I think we're entering a new era with stablecoins, fraud, etc. I think, you know, I mean, just more generally, I think just the, as we talked about, I think just this fintech is no longer just a challenger. Like it's pretty much the backbone of the European tech industry. And for where I'm sitting, I think, yes, AI is redefining the rules of the game. I think, but I think also is what we're going to see from a kind of looking ahead to next year is I think Europe's fintech sector is quietly building towards kind of a wave of IPOs, and that's something that we also touched upon in our report but probably didn't cover too much today. But I think building on the success of Klarna, I think we're going to see a wave of IPOs coming through, and there's about 150 billion of I suppose of pent up or backlog on that side.
It'd be very exciting to look forward to. So watch this space. Parsa, 2026, agentic teams, GI, I don't know. What are your thoughts?
Yeah, I think we're at least a couple of breakthroughs away from AGI. I mean, I personally don't believe all the sort of the news headlines of coming, you know, from the big labs. I think, you know, we have probably saturated much of what could have been done through the sort of scaling laws with the current, you know, transformer architecture and training, you know, the models on all the available data. You know, sort of chain of thought reasoning was the kind of the latest hack that we sort of came up with to kind of keep pushing the performance of these models. But again, I think we're probably reaching a plateau on that sort of intelligence front until, you know, the R&D investments kind of bring about the next sort of breakthrough in sort of fundamental model capacity. I don't think we're at the point where like just throwing more GPUs and more data at it will sort of yield substantially better models. So I think that's kind of the state we're in. And so, but in the meantime, obviously there's a lot of value to be created with that sort of second integration element and the sort of those experimentations that are ongoing, which are kind of, I think if you're smart as an entrepreneur, as a founder, as a technical leader, you're kind of building things in a way that will just automatically benefit from the next generation of AI models. So in other words, rather than trying to kind of build the next generation of foundation models yourself, you kind of integrate it in such a way that with each generation of future models coming out, your solution will just get better and better. And I think that's probably the winning strategy for technical teams and product teams.
Yeah. And for the institutions, right? Once we crack the AI governance challenge and build that interoperability so you can wire Gen AI, and back to the AI topic, but wire Gen AI into the corporate workflow effectively, the opportunity for integrating and automating front to back is just enormous. So, I mean, that's where we play with the consulting capability, and we're quite excited about that. I mean, we've been talking about it for a long time, but when you lift the lid on your average compliance department or finance department, you realize that there's still a lot to be done. So I think we're perhaps going to be you know, beyond that tipping point and see mainstream adoption front to back across the enterprises, and the organizations that aren't doing that, I think, are going to find it harder to catch up. We talked about this actually recent episode in the crypto context about going on chain and the organizations who aren't involved and on the front foot, and how there's going to be a gap opening up between those who do and those who don't. And I think that's very much true in the AI space as well. So plenty to watch out for. And for those who are sort of in the middle of all of this, never a dull moment for next year.
I think it's a fascinating moment in time that we're at.
Yeah. So if folks in the audience made it this far in the conversation and want to find out some more, reach out to either of you, Mike, where to go?
Yeah. So, if they want to reach out to me directly, I'm at mike@finchcapital.com. If they want to read the report and read our commentary, it's finchcapital.com/research.
And that was going to be my other question, actually, was what are you reading or listening to other than the Finch report on the state of European fintech? Anything that you'd recommend to the audience?
If you really want to know the truth, it's probably the Arsenal Man City blog morning.
There you go. Yeah, we only want the real answers on this show. Parza, so anything that you'd recommend to the audience, and where should folks go if they want to hear more from you?
You can connect with me on LinkedIn. I'm Parsa Ghaffari, very sort of open to any interesting conversations there. In terms of what to read, I mean, yeah, like the just staying on top of the news. I kind of have my, you know, Financial Times subscription is kind of the main thing I use personally to stay up to speed. And deep research, you know, deep research is a lifesaver. You can kind of get sort of top analyst firm level, or maybe sort of like junior person in top analyst firm level reports out of deep research. So, you know, I kind of often have, you know, one of these agents kind of doing some research for me in the background, and I get a notification 15 minutes later with a sort of a decent report. So, you know, if there are folks out there who are still not using these type of deep research functionalities, I would suggest that they give it a try.
Yeah, echo that. We've recently started doing it for client intelligence reports, and it's extraordinary what can be uncovered. Listen, thank you both for taking time to share some insights to come on the show. We've timed out, and if folks want to learn some more, there's a super in-depth Finch report, and there's all the things that Parza's posting on LinkedIn. Now you've got a bit of a following on there, I saw. And there's lots out there. But for today's conversation, we'll draw it to a close. And thanks very much.
Sonny, appreciate you having us on here.
Thanks, Sonny.